This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. On today's show, we're going to look at all the talk of trade war between America and China. It's been an up and down week as the threat of tariffs escalated, then subsided. The U.S. and global markets got jittery, then some of them stabilized. We're going to put this in the context of Bible prophecy with a couple of reports. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques will bring us up to speed on the most recent dispute between China and the U.S. to help us put that in its prophetic context. We'll also hear a report from trumpet writer Andrew Miller about China is positioning itself to dominate several islands throughout Asia that will give it control over vital trade routes in the region. This will have major implications for Australia, first and foremost, and it does fulfill a specific biblical prophecy. Later in the show, we're going to have a conversation with trumpet writer Josue Michels about the rise in trends within Europe that show a return of the troubling conditions that led to World War II. Anti-Semitism is rising, as is support for nationalist politicians. People are forgetting the horrors of that war. They're actually romanticizing Nazi-era imagery and ideas. And a new study in Austria shows that a majority of Austrians believe a genocidal event like the Holocaust could happen again. So do stick around for that conversation. And also at the end of the show, I'll have a last word about how if you find yourself getting worn down by the struggles that often come with family life, there's some important truth you need to keep in mind. We'll begin, though, with the trade dispute between the U.S. and China in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
At the beginning of May, it looked like the U.S. and China were almost certain to sign a trade deal. Both sides were sending signals that an agreement to end many of the trade frictions between them was very near, and they were scheduled to sign those frictions away at a signing ceremony in Washington on Friday, May 10th. Global markets were buoyed by the optimism that China and the U.S. were projecting. But in just a matter of days, the whole dynamic changed. On Sunday, May 5th, U.S. President Donald Trump suddenly announced that the U.S. would be raising tariffs from 10 to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods in the next few days. This seemed to be a bolt from the blue. It seemed out of nowhere at a time when things were looking so promising. But what we found out over the next few days was that this announcement from President Trump was a reaction to news that China was suddenly unwilling to carry through on virtually any of the terms it had previously signaled that it would agree to. The Chinese had read a tweet by President Trump written on April 30th, in which he encouraged the U.S. Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. And the Chinese interpreted this tweet as meaning that the U.S. economy was weaker than either side had been banking on. And so they thought the U.S.'s hand was weaker than previously thought, and that as a result, the U.S.'s resolve was weakening. And the Chinese were emboldened by this. So the Chinese leadership decided not to change any laws about China's deceitful trade practices, including its theft of intellectual property and trade secrets. And they decided they would come to that May 10th meeting with a draft of their trade agreement that was so heavily edited, it barely resembled the original version that the U.S. thought they would be signing. Reuters wrote an exclusive about this on May 8th. Writing, quote, "The diplomatic cable from Beijing arrived in Washington late on Friday night, May 3rd, with systematic edits to a nearly 150-page draft agreement that would blow up months of negotiations between the world's two largest economies, according to three U.S. government sources and three private sector sources briefed on the talks." End quote. So this document was rife with reversals and turnarounds. It was riddled with blunt refusals by China to give in on pretty much any of the illegal practices that have been pillars of Chinese growth over the last few decades. In all seven chapters of this trade deal document, China had reversed the commitments it had previously said it would change. These were about things that prompted the U.S. to start the trade war in the first place. Theft of intellectual property and trade secrets, forced technology transfers, currency manipulation, access to financial services, and illegal subsidy policies. These were all things that China was refusing to budge on. By editing this document, the Chinese were insisting that they would not discontinue any of these shameful and entirely illegal policies. So it was on May 3rd that this document, showcasing China's proud defiance, arrived in Washington. And we don't know exactly when President Trump would have seen it, but it was less than 2 days later that he made that May 5th announcement that the U.S. would be raising tariffs from 10 to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods in the next few days. And that was mostly intended to try to talk some sense into the Chinese leadership and to show them that they had misread that tweet about interest rates, and to demonstrate that the U.S. still had the resolve to remain firm on its demands. But the May 10th meeting came and went, and the Chinese remained defiant. They were still emboldened, apparently because of a misunderstanding of that tweet. But whether that was the real reason for their sharp reversal, they maintained their defiance and their refusal to reform. So that same day, the tariff increase went into effect, 25%. And the global markets really took a hit from this. There was one pair of tweets that President Trump posted. These were about his intention to boost those tariffs. And if you do the math there, you see that for each of the 102 words in those two tweets, there was $13 billion erased from global stocks. So $13 billion per word for 102 words ended up wiping $1.36 trillion off the stocks. Just a stunning amount, which reveals the fear and the volatility of these tensions between the U.S. and China, which are the world's two largest economies. China, for its part, is retaliating. Beijing announced on Monday of this week, May 13th, that it will be increasing tariffs on $60 billion worth of American goods. So China will be putting tariffs, lifting them from 5 to 25%. On those goods that it imports from the United States. And there's also some talk about China possibly using its nuclear option to hit back at the U.S. This is not about nuclear weapons, but about taking an action that is staggeringly drastic. And that is dumping its holdings of U.S. treasuries. China currently holds about $1.13 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries and almost 18% of U.S. securities that are held by foreign governments. So China is America's biggest creditor. Many analysts can't imagine a scenario in which China would use this nuclear option and dump these holdings, because that would also cause considerable harm to the Chinese economy. So they say, no, China wouldn't do something so illogical. But those analysts are not really factoring human nature into their analysis. Human nature can be illogical. The nature of conflict and war often defies basic logic, and a nation sometimes knowingly inflicts harm on itself as a necessary byproduct of injuring its enemy. Another thing Western analysts don't normally factor into their calculus of China is Wu Wang Gao Qi. This is a phrase that China's 1.4 billion people memorize in school, and they see it over and over again in state propaganda, and it translates to, don't forget national humiliation. The Chinese are taught over and over again about the humiliation that China has suffered from foreign powers, starting with the Opium Wars and all the unequal treaties that were forced on China. And it resulted in a century of humiliation for the Chinese that they are far from forgetting. And they are still deeply resentful about that. And the Chinese view the United States as a modern extension of the imperial powers that authored this century of humiliation. So Wu Wang Gao Qi means the Chinese will be ready to take drastic steps, even illogical ones, and even steps that might cause some suffering for their own country in order to right what was wronged in their national humiliation. So this nuclear option for China is something we should keep a close eye on, because it would likely send the U.S. economy into a tailspin that it may never recover from. But in either case, whether this nuclear option is played or not, the trade war between the U.S. and China is suddenly and dramatically escalating. And the reason this matters is because trade wars can very easily become hot wars. Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald wrote about this in the Trumpet's April 2017 print edition. In an article that's proven very prescient called Trade Wars Have Begun, he wrote, quote, "The world trade order is currently being reconfigured in an astonishing way. This transformation is already impacting trade relations and facets of some economies, but soon it will significantly impact every national economy, every national government, and every major international relationship. The political and geopolitical ramifications will be extraordinary." End quote. Mr. McDonald from there talks about the U.S.'s relinquishing of world leadership and Britain's departure from the European Union, and how those two developments are giving other world powers an opening to become global hegemons. He points to Germany's increasing economic power and to China's, and discusses the trade alliance that is forming between these two. And he points out that these nations are positioning themselves to undermine and oppose America and Britain. And he then writes, quote, "We are in the early stages of a massive global trade war," end quote. So that was April of 2017 when that was written. And with the developments over the last few months, and especially those from earlier this month, I think we can say we are now into the intermediate stages of that war. And Bible prophecy shows that these disputes will not fade away. Even if the particular tensions that we're currently seeing between the U.S. and China cool in the near term, and even if a degree of normalcy returns to the U.S.-China trade relationship, the long-term view that Bible prophecy gives us shows that Europe and Asia will eventually form an end-time trade axis, and that they'll use it to block the U.S. and the U.K. out.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. You were talking about just how much the when any of these kinds of discussions begin to unfold, or any kind of tension between the U.S. and China occurs, the markets immediately respond in pretty dramatic ways, and you start to see this massive volatility. It shows just how critical these relationships are, and how much this really could cause huge disturbances in the global economy should these kinds of trade disputes escalate.
That's exactly right. These are the two largest economies in the world. They're intricately intertwined with, you know, dozens, hundreds of other economies, and those markets are fragile. It's all so precariously balanced that, you know, to me it blows my mind that a tweet can suddenly erase $1 trillion of wealth from the world. Now, a few days later, that wealth usually returns once a bit of confidence is restored in the investors. But it really does show just how fragile the whole system can be.
So it's interesting to, it does seem like things kind of calmed down after a day or so, although there are investors that are saying we don't expect the calm to remain, that these jitters aren't over, and clearly the disputes between the United States and China haven't been resolved in the long term. But what does this reveal about China's intent regarding the U.S. economy, and maybe you could even contextualize it in other moves that China has made, showing that it's positioning itself to try to replace the United States as the dominant economic power?
Yes, well, even the name China in the Chinese language translates to Middle Kingdom. And really, that show it denotes a central view of the country. They view themselves as the middle of the world, the center of focus, the just kind of the focal point of everything. And they resent the fact that the U.S. is more powerful than them militarily and economically. And they've been determined to take what they view as their rightful place as the Middle Kingdom, the central focus of the world, basically the world leading power. They're determined to kind of assume that position. And so I think if we keep that in mind, really everything that China does makes a lot of sense. They are just utterly determined to basically conquer the world, as you know, that sounds a little bit alarmist to phrase it that way, but that truly is their motivation, and they've been working steadily toward that, and they feel justified in using all of these illegal trade policies to do it. They feel that if they're stealing intellectual property from the U.S., that's good. It's justified because it helps them achieve that goal of becoming the kind of the, you know, the world ruler.
Mm-hmm. You've written an article for the next print edition of The Trumpet, and we talked about it on the radio a couple of weeks ago about just China's efforts to create this Belt and Road Initiative and draw a lot of nations in the world into trade relationships with China. What's happening here, this is a bilateral dispute between the United States and China, but a lot of other nations are affected by this, obviously, and it does seem like there are other nations that share China's goal of trying to reshape the global economy to be one that is less dependent on the United States. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, yes. There's suddenly been quite a few efforts that are kind of coalescing to form massive trade blocs that exclude the United States. The U.S. is working with the Mercosur nations in Latin America right now. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote a very powerful article about that in, I believe it's our March issue of the print edition. Japan is also forming kind of a successor to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the big difference is that the TPP was to include the U.S., but its successor excludes it. Mm. And so this is a very powerful, that's actually the world's largest trade bloc, and that was recently ratified. And then in addition to those two, there are efforts by Europe and Japan to form trade blocs. Of course, Europe and China are forming the same. So I just think it's staggering that the thing they all have in common is excluding the United States. And it really does show a trend that many nations of the world are hoping to block the U.S. out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made mention of a prophecy at the end. You said Bible prophecy shows an axis between Europe and Asia that's going to block the U.S. out. Explain that to us.
Sure. This is mostly in Isaiah 22 and 23. It talks about a mart of nations that will be formed in the end time shortly before the return of Jesus Christ. And verse 1 of Isaiah 23 says that a nation called Chittim will be one of the head countries in this bloc. And Mr. Flurry writes about this in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, and he explains that Chittim is an ancient name for modern China. And then the passage also names Tyre as one of the head players in this block. And Mr. Flurry explains that represents the commercial center of Europe. So that will also be one of the lead players. This passage and related passages also give ancient names for the people that make up modern Japan and Russia. You know, so, and these are all discussed in the prophecies as forming just kind of a trade block that excludes the U.S., and eventually they even form a siege against the United States. If you look at Ezekiel 5 and Deuteronomy 28, it shows that these nations eventually use this trade alliance not just to block the U.S. out of trade, but to actually lay an economic siege around it. So these are prophecies that we can see the stage being set for the fulfillment of right now. And it's amazing, I think, to see it all playing out just as it was written in the Bible thousands of years ago, and just to see God bringing these prophecies to fulfillment. And I think that should make us want to understand the Bible and the mind that's accomplishing all of this.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the prospect of trade war between the United States and China. He mentioned a couple of articles that we have, or an article and a booklet. The one by Brad McDonald, Trade Wars Have Begun. The other, the booklet by Gerald Flurry, Isaiah's End Time Vision, that puts this in prophetic context. We'll put links to both of those in the show notes for today's program. And also, Jeremiah is working on an article on this subject for thetrumpet.com. You can keep your eye on the front page for that. We sure appreciate you helping us to put all this in context for us, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
At the same time that China is working to leverage its economic power against the United States, it is spreading its influence and positioning itself to dominate economically and militarily throughout Asia, and to gain power over Australia, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Prime Minister Peter O'Neill of Papua New Guinea presided over the groundbreaking ceremony of a $285 million Chinatown in Port Moresby last month. About 20,000 Chinese nationals live and work in Papua New Guinea, and the new project will feature apartments, shops, restaurants, and hotels for these nationals. Operating under Chinese President Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Program, Chinese-owned enterprises have ramped up their investments in Papua New Guinea and many other nations across the South Pacific. But these investments are not purely altruistic. They're part of a strategy to conquer nations across the South Pacific. China is also building huge infrastructure projects in Fiji, Vanuatu, and the Solomon Islands. And it is lending these nations huge sums of money. The Chinese government knows these nations are too poor to pay the money back, but it lends anyway because it wants these nations in its debt. When they inevitably default on their loans, China will be able to seize infrastructure as collateral and turn it to military use. This strategy is called debt trap diplomacy. The reason China is so interested in Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and the Solomon Islands is that these islands sit astride some of the most vital shipping lanes in the world. If China is able to militarize these shipping lanes, it will be able to isolate Australia and become master of the South Pacific. Both history and Bible prophecy shows why this is extremely dangerous. Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and the Solomon Islands were all once part of the British Empire. During World War II, the Japanese Empire invaded both Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands. And some of the bloodiest battles of the last century were fought over coral atolls and volcanic outcrops in these islands. The Japanese sought to conquer these specks on the map because they were located along the main trade arteries between Asia and Australia. Now, China is attempting to succeed where Japan failed by using debt trap diplomacy instead of kamikaze fighters. If China can leverage its economic ties into airfields and naval bases, it will have Australia almost surrounded. Three of Australia's five main trade routes pass by nations being economically colonized by China. Australia's trade with the United States passes by Fiji. Australia's trade with Japan passes by the Solomon Islands, and Australia's trade with Europe passes by Papua New Guinea. A 2016 defense white paper makes Australia's predicament clear. It says, Australia cannot be secure if our immediate neighbors, including Papua New Guinea, Timor-Leste, and the Pacific Island countries, becomes a source of threat to Australia. This includes the threat of a foreign military power seeking influence in ways that could challenge the security of our maritime approaches. By conquering South Pacific nations, China is preparing to economically besiege Australia. At one time, the English-speaking peoples controlled virtually every maritime choke point and sea gate on the planet. How did these nations grow to dominate global trade to such an extent? In his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong explained that it all began with a promise made to the patriarch Abraham. God promised to give Abraham's descendants control over the gates of their enemies. Now, a gate is a narrow passage of entrance or exit. And when speaking nationally, a gate is a narrow choke point like the Torres Strait south of Papua New Guinea. God gave Britain and America these commercial gates, ensuring that they would become economic and military superpowers. But God also warned that if America and Britain did not obey him, then they would not only have these sea gates taken away, these sea gates would be used against them. The fact that China is making inroads into territories once used by America and Britain to win World War II shows how close this prophecy is to being fulfilled.
I really appreciate you talking about this, Andrew. This is an element of what China is up to that we haven't heard a whole lot about. We've talked a fair bit about China's other activities in the region, in the South China Sea, and the efforts it's taking to militarize some of those man-made islands in order to secure these shipping lanes. Maybe you could just talk about what you discussed in the report in larger context of what China has been up to.
Right. The Chinese definitely have a desire to be a global superpower and have a very well thought out strategy towards achieving that end. They almost have like a 5-step strategy towards exerting their influence over two oceans, the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, the South China Sea, element that falls into step one. What I'm talking about today in Australia is more towards step two, maybe step two and a half. But I can just kind of lay that out here, is that there's actually like 5 more or less island chains, either man-made or artificial, that they need to dominate in order to dominate these two oceans. Now, the South China Sea butts right up close to China. That's where all their maritime trade has to come through the South China Sea to get to China's coastline. So that's step one, is to dominate the South China Sea. And that's why you hear all these news stories about them building, dredging up sand and building islands in the South China Sea and exerting their influence over the Philippines and building up their navy, as if they can dominate those islands in the South China Sea. That secures the waters along their coast. That's step one. But after that, there's another island chain that runs further out, starting up around Japan, going down close to the U.S. territory of Guam, and then heading south to Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu and the Solomon Islands and some of these islands we talked about today. So if you can control that island chain, now your influence is stretching away from the South China Sea into the Pacific, even controlling enough trade routes that you could economically cut Australia off from much of the rest of the world if they became an obstacle to your plans for world domination.
So it's essentially treating these islands as fixed aircraft carriers.
Right. That is, I alluded to that briefly before about, you have some of the bloodiest battles of World War II, or like names you'll hear like Guadalcanal, mm-hmm. which or Iwo Jima, or some of these islands that are basically like glorified coral reefs, mm-hmm. or like a volcanic, just you can't grow anything there. It's just coral and sand. And
but their strategic position renders them quite significant.
Right. And so you send this wave after wave after wave of the best and U.S. Marines we had to fight some over these some very islands. And I even remember thinking when I was younger, it's like, why don't you have these battles over like some nice place where you can where you can grow something, or where actually someone would want to live? But they know that all those nice places are reliant on trade that comes on ships that passes through sea gates that are dominated mm-hmm. by islands like Iwo Jima and Guadalcanal, and so that's where the Pacific Theater in World War II was won or lost on those islands.
So we were talking in the first segment with Jeremiah about the trade battles that are shaping up between the United States and China. We tend to look a lot at the United States and at being the economic superpower of the world. That's really the primary target of a lot of the efforts that China is making to try to reshape the global economy. Australia is in its crosshairs as well, and we've reported in the past about just how much Australians are seeing their land being bought up by China, and it does seem like the Chinese influence in that region and over that nation is increasing to the point that you have quite a lot of Australians that are concerned. You were talking about the United States and Britain in prophecy, but explain why Australia factors so heavily into those same prophecies.
Right. Well, Australia was part of the British Empire, like Papua New Guinea and Fiji and Vanuatu and the Solomon Islands, those other islands I named. Even more significant is that they're actually, those other islands were British colonies, but there aren't actually very many British people living there, where Australia was definitely colonized by Great Britain. And so the people who live there are, they're the same people as mm-hmm. that settled America and Britain. And so when God's making these prophecies against the United States and Britain, it's not necessarily prophecies about specific chunks of land. It's prophecies to affect a specific people, wherever they may have settled. Mm-hmm. And so they call it the United States and Britain in prophecy because those are the two dominant Anglo-Saxon nations. But the same, I mean, they, as the book makes clear, those same people settled Canada and Australia and New Zealand and even some in South Africa. And so those nations fall under those same prophecies as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting subject. We appreciate that, Andrew. We've been talking to trumpet writer Andrew Miller about China's efforts to take control of the trade routes throughout Asia, including those that give it control over Australia. He's working on an article and a video for thetrumpet.com on the subject. You can watch for that. And also, we'll put a link in the show notes to an article by Gerald Fleury called China is Steering the World Toward War. That also puts what China is doing in its prophetic context. And The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. We appreciate your time, Andrew. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
World War II was the most destructive and lethal war in human history, but it ended nearly 74 years ago, and most people relegate its lessons to ancient history. However, anti-Semitism is rising in Europe at alarming rates. Support for nationalist politicians is rising. A new study shows that in Austria, a majority of people believe a genocidal event like the Holocaust could happen again in Europe. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Mr. Hilliker.
It's good to have you here. So, first of all, can you just tell us some of the specifics about how this trend is playing out in Europe?
No, quite a few people are alarmed. Over the recent years, Germany has changed quite a bit, and fears that were thought to be suppressed are coming up again. For example, during the refugee crisis, Germany has taken in more than 1 million refugees, but as a result, Germany has shown one of its ugly heads again. In 2016, we had more than 3,600 attacks on refugees. Some of the refugees' houses were burned up.
And over what period was that again?
That was in 2016.
Oh, okay.
3,600 attacks on refugees or refugee facilities. Quite a few videos made spread that time, as we saw shelters on fire, and some German people tried even to stop the fire brigade to do their work. But then in 2017 and 2018, we saw a slight decline of those attacks, and many Germans attacked more and more Jews in their country again. And that was also a sign that the fears of old that was sort of be overcome are rising again. I just have a statistic here that came out today from the German Federal Office of the Interior Minister, and talked about just this increase in attacks on the Jews, and said anti-Semitic offenses increased by 19.6% to 1,799 attacks or offenses in 2018. Mm. And it says the overwhelming majority came from right-wing offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And also this on May 1st, we saw Nazi marches again. So those marches were popular during the lead-up to after Hitler's rise in 1933 and during his reign. In essence, on that day, on May 1st, 300 German right-wing extremists dressed up as SS officers or SS soldiers and marched through German city, and the police watched them as they shouted propaganda against the Jews and basically said, "We are Hitler people and not Democrats." And that made another scandal as the police just watched, which reminded me of another scandal that happened in 2016, 2017, where news broke that many high officers in the army and the police forces associate themselves with the Nazi ideologies and even created chat groups where they spread the dangerous poison with one another. And that was allowed to happen in the army. So those are just a few of the scandals that brought the fears of the old again in the national thinking. And
so if you have, say, 300 people in a march like that, and you have some of these high profile incidents where it's very overt, blatant Nazi era, the resurrection of Nazi era symbols and that type of thing, how much does that represent the real threat, and how much of it is, say, a subtler form of the same kind of ideals or prejudices that you saw in the 1930s, but that don't maybe express themselves in those overt ways?
That's a very good point, because most people in Germany would strongly oppose the May marches, they would strongly oppose attacks on refugees, or strongly oppose attacks on Jews. But what the statistics show is that many more people today are not afraid anymore to use violence to spread their ideas. And I read quite a few reports that talk about how they don't allow anyone to defend Jews or defend refugees when they are around, and are even not afraid to use violence to suppress any criticism of their ideas. Now, those are still the minority of people, but the fact is that the German media as a whole often represents what Israel does in the Middle East, for example, as Israel as the offender. So many people in Germany believe that Israel is the cause of many of the problems that the Middle East is facing. Some may even associate that with the refugee crisis and other problems that Germany is currently facing. So there's an overall underlying principle that more and more Germans are feeling insecure. Some might think the problem has to do with the Jews. Others believe it has more to do with Muslim immigration. Others just simply don't know what's happening. But it didn't take much in the lead-up to World War II. It just took a few thousand people that were willing to use violence, and hundreds of thousands more were supporting it, and millions just went along with it. But as the events increased, they also supported the new strong leader.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, Hitler used the sentiments of both the left and the right to really use it to propagate his ideas. He didn't just use the extremes, because that would have been rejected. And we also know from Bible prophecy that in this end time, the leader will act more subtly. He will maybe oppose the right-wing violence, and he will also oppose hatred against Jews in Israel, and those ideas will be much more popular. But at the same time, you know, Bible prophecy foretells that he will act with deceit and use the violent extremists and their ideas to lead them again to war, but just in a more subtle way.
So we've had a couple of articles about this on thetrumpet.com lately. You wrote one of them that maybe you could summarize for us. And the title of this article was, Did Germany Ever Learn the Lessons of the Nazis? This was based on an article that appeared in the New York Times. Could you just summarize this article for us?
Yes, a New York Times opinion piece asked the question, has Germany forgotten the lessons of the Nazis? And basically argues that the events currently unfolding in Germany show that a dangerous trend is repeating itself because many Germans don't know what happened during World War II and in the lead up to it. It summarizes the rise of the Germany's far-right party, the Alternative for Deutschland party, that has made a dramatic rise in Germany and has received 13% in the last election, and it propagates a strong hatred against refugees and basically says Germany has to use a closed border policy when it comes to immigration of refugees. Alternative for Deutschland party has made headlines with anti-Semitic ideologies. For example, it promotes that Germany should take down the monuments that remind Germany of its past. It calls them symbols of shame in the midst of Germany's capital and said no other country uses such monuments, and it believed that Germany has to honor its history more, that Germany can rise to more national greatness again, and basically said, condemned Germany's history of remembrance. And many people support that because they are afraid that Germany is so overwhelmed with its history that it doesn't make any progress anymore. That's one of the main things this party argues. Mm-hmm. And it argues that that's why Germany allowed so many refugees in their country, because it believes that they are so hard on themselves and so hard on their history.
So, and that that's a fairly major platform of the Alternative for Deutschland, isn't it? Now, this party had been more on the fringe of German politics, but in recent elections, it showed itself to be, what, the second most popular party within the country, and it seems to have tried to refurbish its image to the point where it's appealing more to mainstream in Germany. How much is the, say, like they've had to distance themselves from maybe those associations with the more extreme element of the kind of trend that you're talking about here. Isn't that true?
They do try to make a difference between the really right-wing extremist groups and the violent groups. And that's also because many Germans oppose them, and the government has also done a lot to hamper the refugee influx into Germany. So they are facing many challenges, as the refugee crisis is currently not as big of an issue anymore. And still, they are constantly over 10% in surveys, which shows that they are now legitimate party in the German parliament that's likely to remain one over the next few years.
We had another article, this one by Michael Davis. The title of this is Europe on the Verge of Another Holocaust? And there were just some quite astounding statistics in this article. It said that the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany reported that in Austria, 58% of Austrians believe that a genocidal event like the Holocaust could happen again in Europe. They did say that a lot, over half of the people didn't, they underestimated the number of Jews that were murdered during World War II. There was almost 1 in 10 that said that it was an exaggeration to say that it was 6 million Jews. 12% of them estimated to be as low as 100,000. So that's a pretty substantial group of among Austrians that have very little understanding, as just the same way that you were mentioning about Germans, just downplaying the horrors of what happened in World War II. But still, maybe you could just talk a little bit about why it is that Austrians, looking at the situation, are saying we could be entering into conditions that would lead to another Holocaust.
Yeah, just the fact that so much anti-Semitism is on the rise and some of the other developments we discussed a little bit earlier here, it just shows that some of the same trends as leading up to World War II are happening again. And Austria in the lead up to World War II was basically overrun by Germany, so it's not a surprise that they are a little bit more afraid of such an increase in some of the same sentiments in Europe currently. But it also showed that just because of the lack of education here in Austria and in Europe, that many people just believe that if people don't remember their history, they're doomed to repeat the history. The fact that all those things are happening again shows that there was a lack of understanding just after World War II ended. As the Allied forces occupied Germany, they demanded the denazification of Germany's education system. Its army was demolished and abandoned, and just demanded that Europe and Germany in particular has to have a new beginning. But just a few years after they made that announcement, they handed the denazification into the hand of Germany's government. And recent figures have showed that that denazification progress wasn't as thorough as many people believed it was. And that's something we have pointed out for decades. We have a booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, that goes through that history, and it specifically talks about one of Herbert W. Armstrong's, a late theologian from the 20th century, who talked about the failure of denazification of Germany and said that the Nazis went underground, and he prophesied, based on scriptures in Revelation 17, that the Nazis will emerge again. And in essence, he said that they are planning a world, that they have planned a World War III, even as Germany went down in World War II. The same propaganda machines went just underground, and their ideologies never died. The school education relied heavily on former Nazis. The newly found German army relied heavily on Nazi officers. So it's no surprise that those ideas are resurfacing again, as they never really have stopped. They only really went underground after World War II, but Nazism never really died.
Well, thank you for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels. He's our Germany specialist. He's a native of Germany, and he's written an article that you can find on thetrumpet.com, Did Germany Ever Learn the Lessons of the Nazis? We'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's program, as well as the other article that we talked about, Is Europe on the Verge of Another Holocaust? And I also put one from Richard Palmer. He wrote an article in the 2012 print edition of The Trumpet called Deja Vu, The 1930s Are Coming Back. You can find all of those links on thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much for your time, Josue.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Some say family isn't worth it. You've seen the wry comments on greeting cards and tacky coffee mugs. Marriage is not a word, it's a sentence. Marriages are made in heaven, but then again, so are thunder, lightning, tornadoes, and hail. The first half of our lives is ruined by our parents, the second half by our children. These ideas come from people who don't understand God's purpose for family. Knowing why family helps us to see the so-called negatives for what they really are: noble sacrifices for an awesome purpose. In his book, Straight Talk to Men, James Dobson discusses something he calls the straight life. For a man in a family, he says, this is pulling your tired frame out of bed 5 days a week, 50 weeks out of the year. It is earning a two-week vacation in August and choosing a trip that will please the children. The straight life is spending your money wisely when you'd rather indulge in a new whatever. It's taking your son bike riding when you want so badly to watch the baseball game. It's cleaning out the garage on your day off after working 60 hours the prior week. The straight life is coping with head colds and engine tune-ups and crabgrass and income tax forms. It's giving a portion of your income to God's work when you already wonder how ends will meet. The straight life for the ordinary garden variety husband and father is everything I have listed and more, much more. Yes, family involves sacrifice. Any man who's married with kids and is doing his job can identify with that to some degree. And the straight life for a wife is often even less glamorous. Viewed from a purely selfish perspective, it seems like a string of hassles. Many who do not understand why family seek to achieve its benefits without its sacrifice. Get a load of these excerpts from The Personal Marriage Contract, written by Dr. John F. Whitaker in 1976. He wrote, I understand that nothing is forever, that there are no absolute guarantees, and that now is the only real forever. I will love, honor, and respect, but not obey or subjugate myself to you until either of us changes his mind and maintains a change of attitude for a period of 1 year or until the termination date of the contract. Don't expect me to accept you as you are when you fail to maintain physical attractiveness and fail to take care of your body. I will put myself first. By keeping myself full, satisfied, and not hungry, I will have an abundance of joy, love, and caring to give to you. Wow. It doesn't exactly make you swoon with feelings of romance, does it? We may not take it as far as that man did, but we do naturally tend to approach marriage selfishly. As long as you're taking care of my needs, I'll take care of yours. If you uphold your end, then I'll uphold my end. But will that kind of marriage work? Would even that kind of friendship work? Imagine if God's love was so conditional. Instead of him saying, I'll never leave you, I'll never forsake you, as he does in Hebrews 13:5, imagine him saying, don't expect me to hang around if I don't like what I see. If you're not fulfilling my needs, this really isn't going to work. That is not God's love. God's love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. God's love never ends, it says in 1 Corinthians 13. Human love centers on the self. God's love centers on the other person and living your life for someone else. It's not always comfortable or glamorous. Jesus Christ truly lived the straight life. His whole life was about serving, being faithful and obedient. Never once did he say, I'm just going to do this for me. I've earned this. I deserve some indulgence here. No, he said, I do always those things that please my Father. He truly sacrificed. He died in order to have a family, but he did it willingly because he had God's love. Many couples want a 50-50 marriage, but for a marriage to be as great as it can be, it must be 100-100. Each spouse has a role, and each must give it all he or she can. That's the way God's love works. And that's irrespective of the other person. Christ, our role model, died for us while we were yet sinners. What are you really giving up by living the straight life? Well, you're giving up selfishness. Yes, you have to forego some personal desires that aren't inherently bad, but we're not here for ourselves. And on the other hand, what do you gain by living the straight life? You gain love. You gain family, security, stability. You gain a peace that someone who's out chasing after his own desires just can't understand. And meanwhile, you're learning about God and you're living the family life He designed, and you're growing and you're maturing in the process. That's quite a trade-off. Evaluate the quality of your love. Measure your patience, your loyalty, your constancy against that of Jesus Christ. Live for your family. Ask God to help you think like Him. Thank God for showing you that straight and narrow way that leads to life. And embrace the straight life. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts you have on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Josue Michels. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Ogden Nash. To keep your marriage brimming with love in the loving cup, whenever you're wrong, admit it. Whenever you're right, shut up. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.